This week, Chicago officially entered the competition to snag that final rose from the most eligible economic bachelor, Amazon.
Illinois is far and away the best location for Amazon's second headquarters.
That's the governor wooing the online superstore to our state on CNBC. We talk about what Amazon headquarters can mean in terms of jobs and infrastructure for Illinois. Plus, a new documentary from Illinois Public Media called Still Here features Illinois voices from the Vietnam War.
Still Here also implies those voices who didn't make it, who are no longer with us. And so it sort of hints at the harsher stories of war that we wanted to reveal through these individual stories and experiences.
And experts foresee another rough flu season this year. Will you go for a flu shot or take your chances? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or tweet to 21STShow and join us for the next hour on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to Amazon, we as customers have a lot of requirements. We want fast streaming video and on-demand Alexa, overnight delivery of the most obscure items from that anniversary gift we might have forgot to buy, to a bathing suit you forgot to pack. Well, now Amazon has requirements of its own. A highly skilled labor force, mass transit, and a world-class university, those are the needs for a second Amazon headquarters, and Chicago wants in. Joining me to talk about our chances of winning this bid and what an Amazon corporate hub can mean for the rest of the state are two professors from the University of Illinois at Chicago's College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs. Michael Pagano is the dean and professor of public administration, and he's on the line with us from Chicago. David Merriman is also in the Department of Public Administration here with me in our Chicago studios. David, Mike, welcome to the 21st.
Hi.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. And David, welcome back, I should say. David, let's start with some of the numbers that are being floated. An estimated 50,000 jobs, $341 billion in total spending. I think oftentimes when we hear about companies being lured to a state, we hear these jobs and numbers. Let's start with the jobs. Are those direct jobs? What are these numbers
really
mean?
Talking about 50,000 direct jobs, and that's a lot of jobs, but it's good to put it in perspective. That's less than 1% of the jobs that are currently in Illinois, about 2% in the Chicago metropolitan area. So I think the way to think about this is, you know, it's big. It's kind of equivalent maybe to a big new university being established. That's kind of the scale we should be thinking about.
And so you should think about that in terms of the spending as well, the $341 billion.
Right, right.
And so, Mike, what about if you're not in Chicago or even suburban Chicago? You live in Peoria or Belleville or Rockford. Governor Rauner has been very excited about what the second headquarters could mean for the state. But how wide a net are we casting in terms of its reach? How will this impact people outside of Chicago?
No, I think the reach can be actually quite far from the city or wherever they're going to locate this, and in part because not only do you have the 50,000 direct jobs associated with Amazon, and meaning that those 50,000, think of those as 50,000 households that they're going to be looking for housing. Not everybody is looking for housing in the central city. People are going to locate all over the region. The other part of that is that there will be additional spillover employment as a result of this that'll generate tens of thousands of additional jobs. They're not all going to be located right next to the headquarters or the major building. So it ought to have a rippling effect throughout the broad regional economy and maybe even beyond. The second part of that is that these spillover connected jobs are going to not only affiliated with Amazon, but just given the density of that number of people coming for this one kind of thing called Amazon, it has a very important outcome, presumably, of generating additional kinds of activities. In other words, not just related to Amazon, but when you get creative minds together, most of these people are going to be college-educated entrepreneurs, in a sense. They're going to be looking for developing and designing other kinds of activities, given the proximity they have with each other. And that, too, I think, can spread beyond just the city of Chicago and beyond to the larger metropolitan region, including Indiana and Wisconsin.
David, do you agree about this being a wide net?
I guess I'm a little more pessimistic than my esteemed dean. You know, I think it's a lot of
for academics to disagree. Right?
It's a lot of jobs, and I think you know, there certainly will be some spillover. But I'm always the question is, what does it displace? So if people are working for Amazon, what are they doing elsewhere? There's the potential for what economists call agglomeration economies, where you get a cluster. In particular, here there's a lot of high tech jobs. And that could really lead to growth, as it has in, you know, a number of other places in Seattle and also obviously in California. But I don't think we should exaggerate, you know, the potential of this. You know, Amazon, if it came here, would be coming here because of a high quality labor force. Other people are going to come here because of a high quality labor force as well. Those are kind of fundamental strengths of the region. And, you know, definitely be a good thing to get Amazon. I don't think it's a game changer.
Before we get back to that, I want to go to the costs of all of this. I was reading one report in the Chicago Tribune that pointed out Amazon has qualified for at least $80 million in state-backed incentives over the next 10 years already for opening 9 different facilities that will employ up to 9,000 workers. And, of course, for those familiar with sort of the economic incentives that states use to lure companies, Foxconn, just over the border in Wisconsin, we will know that Wisconsin shelled out $3 billion. That's over the next 25 years for Foxconn, the Taiwanese company. Mm-hmm. I wanted to actually, Governor Rauner was on the 21st a few weeks ago, and he talked about incentives. Here's what he had to say about that in regards to Amazon.
We will certainly be talking about what the incentives we need to be competitive. And I was pleased to sign the EDGE tax credit extension bill yesterday so we can offer EDGE tax credits, which most states do offer, so we can be competitive on that. Hopefully we don't have to be so much focused on tax special deals, because I'm not a big fan of that. What we've got to sell is the quality of our workforce, the quality of life, our transportation network, our education system, second to none, and really compete on that. We'll stand up well against any state with what we have to offer in those regards.
Yeah, that's Governor Rauner on the 21st, about a month or so ago, just as he was saying after he signed the EDGE tax credits. David, what are those? Can you explain that?
So EDGE tax credits allow the company to have a credit against its corporate income tax and basically reduce the tax that it pays. And so they can be a significant amount of money. In terms of the package of incentives that are going to be offered, as far as I know, we haven't seen publicly
What they filed privately this week.
What they filed privately this week. But I would expect the typical kind of incentives are somewhere between $20,000 to $200,000 a job. And so we're talking somewhere between $1 and $10 billion. It would be a normal package of incentives for a deal of this size. So it's probably going to be a lot of money, but this is over quite a long period of time, and we're talking about, you know, a lot of investment from Amazon. So I think that's the range I would expect.
And Mike, do you think that – I mean, we see this sort of Amazon announces this and asks every municipality to kind of line up and just offer the money, right? I mean, that's sort of how the game is played here. Do you see the cost calculus of this working out in taxpayers' favor?
Well, I look at it this way. Amazon is going to choose where Amazon wants to go, irrespective of what kind of tax deals are given to it. The location characteristics that they're looking for a place, that might be a sweetener, the whatever tax deal they get, but they're not going to choose some place just because it has the most amount of giveaway. What they're going to look for is the quality of life that they can offer their employees to attract employees. These are high skilled, which means highly mobile employees. They're going to look for, as they said, they want a dense metropolitan area, which means that they're not going to choose small towns just because the small town can give them billions of dollars. That's not going to be the determining factor. Politically, all governors have to get in the game and say that they're going to put stuff up, and they do that. But in terms of whether it makes a difference in the end, it's a very, very marginal thing. What's really going to matter, and I think where the state can be and the city can be instrumental in changing the decision of Amazon to locate here, is to invest in those areas that make the city what Amazon is looking for.
Right.
One of the problems that Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, no. I was just thinking about that. Do you think those investments have been made? We think about transportation and infrastructure in the city of Chicago. Mayor Emanuel has put so much money in the past couple of years into even things like biking and cycling and making sure those lanes are available, saying in his mind, he said repeatedly, these are the kind of things we need to attract young, particularly tech workers to the city. They want to be able to use to bike back and forth to work, to create sort of. Do you think that the city's done enough investment? And when it comes to other locations that are being looked at, Mike, how do you think Chicago compares?
I think Chicago fares generally favorably, but it has a long way to go. It is really investing in areas that will attract this highly skilled workforce, primarily with the bike lanes and that sort of activity. But I think where the city really has to make, or the region has to make an even more investment is in the mass transit system. It has tens of billions of dollars in backlog maintenance in the transit system, and I think that's going to be critical to attracting Amazon. Where I think there's a lot of cities are fall well below Chicago is in not offering the kinds of transportation and transit amenities that the city of Chicago has. So I think on the transportation dimension, both for Amazon and for its workers, so transportation of goods and services in and out of the city with the airports and trains and highways, but also people between work and home, there are many more options, and they're much more environmentally friendly and conducive to the kinds of people who were going to be working at Amazon anyway. I think in that regard, Chicago is probably at the top of the list.
And so when we think about our competitors, Mike, a recent New York Times analysis shows Denver as the place that should be Amazon's mm-hmm. headquarters. But there's also Pittsburgh, which has Uber and Intel. There's other contenders like Raleigh and Boston. Who else are we? I mean, we've even heard of towns like Grand Rapids, Michigan, kind of mm-hmm. submitting a bid. So mm-hmm. who do you think our serious competition is?
I think our serious competition is Austin, possibly Pittsburgh, and Denver. I don't think that's going to go any further east. I think they need to lock down the Midwest, and the question is whether it's the Rocky Mountain Midwest in Denver, which is a very growing and dynamic metropolitan area, but one that I think doesn't have quite the density that Chicago has, and what it does have is lifestyle activities that a lot more. We don't have too many mountains in Chicago, but we do have the lake. So maybe we balance out there.
Right. Have water versus mountains. David, can I ask you, Governor Rauner was on CNBC. He's been sort of making the rounds, being a cheerleader for Illinois in a way, frankly, we haven't heard him be in the past couple of years during the state budget impasse. When we look at our state's credit ratings, mm-hmm. when we look at our inability of our legislature to work together over the past 2 years, is that something? And in fact, I think CNBC gave Illinois a one. They gave us an F for a couple things. I think our grade point average for Illinois was a 1.42 based on the report card they gave. How much does that matter?
Well, yeah, I worry about that. I mean, it's not in the RFP that Amazon put out, but it's got to be a negative factor. I mean, the governor and the mayor have really tried to come together.
And they really have the past month and a half.
Right. But, can that be maintained? Chicago's got a lot of fiscal problems. Does Amazon want to be – they don't want to be in the middle of a food fight between political leaders. And so I think, that's a – got to be a problem, and I think the reason you see the governor and the mayor, stretching across is because they have to recognize that. I just want to add one other thing that we haven't talked about, which is it's a little bit idiosyncratic, but Amazon needs a good site. They're talking about 100 acres of an open site, and Chicago can do well on all the other possibilities if it doesn't have the right site. They'll lose because of that, and that's something I don't think any of us really know. How easy is it to assemble a site where they can build a campus?
And Mike, to that point, the old post office location for folks who everyone who's taken the riverboat tour of Chicago knows or seen the Batman movie where it gets blown up, right? And knows that old location.
Right.
That's, you know, just been in the past couple of weeks. City officials have been very clear about how the lobby is all polished and ready and open to go. Is a site like that, which has a nice sort of historical tie-in back to our Illinois' old catalog companies and the Sears and all of those, is that a kind of site of sufficient?
I don't know that it's sufficient, but it certainly is a step in the right direction. One has to have a very inventive mind to think of the post office as it is now as a site for Amazon. And I think the architects are going to have a field day in trying to figure out what that might look like in the end. But is that the right location? It absolutely is the right location. I think that's where, with access to just about everything there, except maybe a Blue Line connection.
Right, because it's access to the highways, right on the river, very close to downtown in the Loop for downtown Chicago, very good for housing for workers. So that's one possibility. David, just last thoughts about the order of magnitude of this being like a university. You made that analogy. Mm-hmm. Is that how you think we should look at this?
Yeah. I think we should look at it as kind of a campus. It's going to be a new campus. It's going to add a lot of very, you know, well-educated workers to the workforce, and that would certainly be a boost to the city's economy.
To the city's economy, and Mike, to your point, also to the state. I mean, I guess when we're looking at revenue of workers, where the average salary, they're saying all of these 50,000 people are making more than $100,000.
Right.
That's always a good thing revenue-wise, right?
That's right, and it's I think the analogy of a campus, I think we have to think about something broader than just a university campus, because most university campuses in rural areas tend to have most of the students close to the university. I think if you think of the workforce at Amazon as your students, they're going to be scattered all over the region. They're not going to be concentrated right around that campus. In terms of work activity and as a central site for bringing people and ideas together, I think the university analogy is a good one.
That's Michael Pagano, Dean of UIC's College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs, also a professor of public administration, David Merriman, his colleague as well. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nyla.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Coveting Nature, Art, Collecting, and Natural History in Early Modern Europe, an exhibition of botanical artwork from U of I collections. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's been more than 50 years since the U.S. joined the Vietnam War, and over the past few months, public broadcasting has been producing stories to help remember what happened and how the war changed not just this country, but the world. Ken Burns and Lynn Novak's 10-part documentary aired on PBS last month, and this month, Illinois Public Media is releasing its own hour-long radio documentary featuring Illinois voices. It's called Still Here, and it airs this Saturday at 3 p.m. on AM 580 for those in the central Illinois area. It'll also be available online. It features the voices of not just military who fought in the war, but also of civilians who had to flee from their homes. I'm joined now by the producers of Still Here. Kimberly Cronick is the Director of Community Content and Engagement at Illinois Public Media. John Fasile is a Chicago-based journalist and filmmaker. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Nyla. Nice to be here.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Kimberly, let's start with you. What's behind the name of this documentary?
Yeah, great question. Well, Still Here really has at least a couple of meanings. This was something one of our veterans told us in our interviews with them. So Still Here meaning I made it through, either as a combat soldier or as a refugee to another country. Still Here also implies those voices who didn't make it, who are no longer with us. And so it sort of hints at the harsher stories of war that we wanted to reveal through these individual stories and experiences.
And how did you all pick those individual stories and experiences? And why did you want to do that for Illinois? Kimberly?
Yeah, well, first, this is a multi-pronged project. We have been doing oral histories, collecting veterans and refugee stories for a while, since World War II. And we wanted to, we're the local station, so if anyone can tell the local story, it's us. We had a couple dozen to choose from, and we had feedback sessions, and originally in this hour long, we had 11 stories, and we got that down to 7 based on our feedback sessions. Really what I wanted to do, what we wanted to do, is create a place at the listener's table for these 7 people and their direct experiences with America's war in Vietnam. And we as storytellers can do this. We can hold a space for everyone. And then, you know, the listeners get to decide how they want to respond to that space and if they want to keep those folks at the table or not. But we really wanted to provide a tapestry of different experiences that you might not know about from people who might be your friends and neighbors.
And John, when Kimberly says a tapestry of different experiences, what kind of different voices did you all put into this hour?
I think we wanted to get a diverse array of voices and experiences in the piece, but not just focusing on military experiences, although we did include those as well, because obviously that's a huge part of the Vietnam War. We also included an officer in the Army Nurse Corps. We included a pacifist who was imprisoned for resisting the draft. We included refugees, Vietnamese refugees, who had to live as their country was being torn apart, had to flee the war. And we also, you know, we wanted to include different racial perspectives on the war. The African-American experience is a big part of this documentary. We also had one of the features that I'm most proud of is the story of awakening of an LGBT person that happened while overseas in Vietnam. And I'm really proud of all the different perspectives we're able to include in this piece.
Let's actually hear from some of those voices that you all collected. Jerry Wheezy was a combat medic from Rantoul. And here he's describing why he wanted to enlist in the first place.
I was only 18, and I enlisted because the truth of the matter was my heart was broken. My girlfriend had broken up with me. If I could have gone into French Foreign Legion, I probably would have done that instead. I got on the train early in the morning, took the train from Rantoul to Champaign, got off. The recruiter's office was right across the street from where Christie Clinic is, but at the time there was a barber college there. A friend of mine was actually going to school at the barber college. I went to the barber college and told him to take my hair off. And he asked me why, and I told him I was going to walk across the street and join the Army. And he thought I was crazy. I walked across the street and had to walk through protesters from the U of I who were protesting the war of Vietnam. And I walked into the recruiter's office, and I told him I wanted to join the Army, I wanted to volunteer for Vietnam, and I wanted to ship out today.
That's Jerry Wheezy describing his experience of enlisting. Kimberly, such vivid imagery for folks in the Champaign-Urbana area. He really describes exactly where he was. And so for our listeners in that who will know exactly where he is, folks who maybe other people who attended the University of Illinois also would remember that. You know, Kimberly, I think it's easy to forget that so many of the servicemen were so young at the time. And I wonder how the service members you talk to react about when they first went to Vietnam, whether they volunteered or were drafted.
Yeah, great question. Some of them, like Jerry Wheezy, enthusiastically enlisted. Others were drafted. You know, this was a time when World War II veterans were very much celebrated. They fought the, quote, good war. And so young men were sort of swept up in that. Some joined so they could become officers. They'd have more choice. So our veterans talk about that, and also they talk about it with hindsight, with self-reflection. After almost 50 years, they talk about what they felt like then and how they look back on that experience now. And I think that perspective is very powerful.
That 50-year perspective, do you find, I wonder if you found Kimberly, a common thread of 50 years on, how people, did people's views really change?
Some of them did. Donald Heitch, who was a gunner in the Marines who enlisted, he said, you know, he went to war overseas as a hero, and he came back in a very different place. And that place was suffering great spiritual and psychological trauma as a result of the killing that he had to do as part of his service. and really recovering from that only in the last several years, and being willing to share his story to perhaps help other veterans who may be experiencing what he experienced.
And then there are the people who, as Jerry talks about, he had to walk through the protesters. You really cannot talk about Vietnam without talking about the protests that happened during this time in this country against that. I wanted to ask John about one of the people featured as someone who resisted the draft, Timothy Kendall. What did you all learn about people in Illinois who decided to protest Vietnam, and what did that look like at the time?
When he started resisting the draft, he was actually in school at Notre Dame. We connected with him, I believe, through a professor at the University of Illinois. Isn't that right?
That's correct. Burley? Yeah, the professor that harbored Timothy when he was did not register for the draft and was basically an outlaw.
And where did he harbor him, Kimberly?
In his home. And this is a professor.
In Urbana?
No, not in Urbana. They live in Urbana now. They were at Notre Dame, and he and his wife had three kids, and they harbored Timothy Kendall until Timothy decided to turn himself in for consciously refusing to register or be any part of the draft.
And then what happened to him?
He went to prison.
And so he shares that story. Wow. John?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think what surprised us both about Tim was how analogous his experience in prison was to a combat experience. We talk about it a little bit in the piece, or he talks about it a little bit in the piece, the constant threat of violence, the fact that he was brutally assaulted. Other stuff that we left out of the piece include, you know, that the prison that he was at was so lacking in basic medical care that there were a lot of deaths. So he was under this constant stress and strain and facing violence every day that he was, and he was in prison for 17 months. So that was what surprised us about him. He too had suffered a great trauma by standing up for what he believed in.
And I think when we think about this, the trauma of war goes, touches everyone who's involved with it, whether they're in the military or, as you were saying, in the case of this gentleman who resisted and was imprisoned. And then, of course, the Vietnamese people themselves. And I wanted to play another piece from the documentary. This is from a woman named Ut Ha, who lives in Urbana now. She was able to get political asylum and make it here to the United States. This is, at this point, she's describing what it was like to grow up in Vietnam before the bombing started.
I was born in Da Lat, Vietnam. Da Lat usually in my head because it's a very beautiful city. Lakes, hills, all the pine tree, all the flowers year round. I used to went with my mom in the morning to all the farms 3 miles away from the center of the city. My mom bought all the strawberries from the farm, and we carry them back to the market to sell to the retailers. Yeah, I have 2 brothers and 6 sisters. I have a big family, a very close family, a loving family, you know.
Kimberly, can you tell us a little bit more about her story? What happened to her after the war started, and how did she make it to Urbana?
Yeah, she moved around a lot. Her family moved to protect the family. She remembers the Tet Offensive very well when the troops surrounded her city, and she had to go to re-education training and schooling. And when it fell to the communists, you know, her mother moved the family to other places. Her and her sister tried multiple times to escape by boat. Her sister finally succeeded in 1987. Ut Ha met her husband, who was a former Marine and prisoner of war, in 1986, and they got married. She was worried she wasn't going to find someone who wasn't a communist that was marriage material, and she did. And because he was a prisoner of war, they were able to fly to the United States and make this their new home in 1990. And Ut and Bon have several children. She still works as a medical interpreter at Carl Hospital. Her husband's now retired. And, that's her story of displacement and sort of regrouping and making a new home here, which is, of course, a very relevant story.
You know, Kimberly, as I listen to these stories, these are very Illinois stories, as I've watched the reaction that people have had to the Ken Burns and Lynn Novak documentary, it strikes me how different the responses are based on generation. You know, in particular, as I've looked at my Facebook feed, for people who remember the war, for people who lived through the war, versus people who are my generation who were born around that time and do not just learned about it. And I learned about it in school, you know, to younger generations who it's really far removed from, right? So I wonder what you were hoping to achieve with this documentary, thinking about all of the generational ways 50 years on we are reacting to this.
Yeah. You know, one of the things we wanted to do was create that intergenerational dialogue. So you have neighbors, family members who served or who resisted. Starting those conversations is something that's happening as a result of this work. We know because we're getting that feedback. We wanted to create an opportunity for people to relate to what they hear to what's happening now, and to put yourselves in other people's shoes is another example. And really to create that space for a conversation that you might not be able to initiate on your own, but we can do for you and invite you in.
John, I wonder, as you worked through this process, was there anything that surprised you about the Illinois stories that you heard?
I am surprised by how divisive the war still is. You know, there were arguments in our feedback sessions about what we were depicting. The veterans that we have talked to seem to still be hurt by their experience, whether they experience something traumatic themselves or whether it's the perception that they see has been created around the war and around Vietnam veterans. So that really, I was sort of not expecting that sharing some of these stories would get the response that it did, including some veterans getting very defensive. That's been part of the feedback we've received as well.
Yeah, and Kimberly, I imagine that's also behind part of the title, Still Here, right? That it doesn't, and I imagine for a lot of people in many ways, 50 years has not really made a difference because of the trauma and the experiences are still with them.
Yeah, and some of the folks that we met want to put it behind them. They did the oral history interview. They gave us feedback on the transcript of that, and now the Lynn and Ken series is on, and, you know, they want to watch it, but, you know, they're kind of done. They're done now. And you know, others are just starting to talk. And so it varies, but it's definitely a sensitive topic, and we certainly tried our best to represent the stories of those who were willing to share, to represent them well and to connect them to other people's stories who may be similar or different.
Kimberly, this documentary is part of a larger effort by Illinois Public Media to educate people about the war. What does that include?
Yeah, so we have collected with our partners the oral histories of veterans and civilians and others that relate to this war, and we've archived those, and then we've taken them and we've created lesson plans for teachers and students in high school where the Vietnam unit is taught, and those are being used all over the country. So these Illinois veteran stories are in lesson plans in classrooms. And then we had feedback sessions where we put this national local content before people and had dialogues. And the final part of that is the series of feature stories and then the hour-long documentary.
That's Still Here. Producers Kimberly Cronick, she's the Director of Community Content and Engagement at Illinois Public Media. John Facile is a Chicago-based journalist and filmmaker. Thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thanks, Nyla.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Guess what? Flu season is here. That means have your hand sanitizer ready. It's that dreaded time of year where maybe a crowded elevator ride or a room full of coughing children feels like a ticking time bomb primed to make you sick. Unfortunately, this flu season is looking like it's going to be a rough one, too. Between 40 to 45% of U.S. adults 18 or older get vaccinated for the flu in a given year. That's according to the CDC. About 60% of children get flu shots as well. That's been steadily trending upward. What about you? Are you going to get a flu shot this year? Tell us why or why not. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet us to 21STShow. We'd love to hear from you. Again, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. The flu is something that may be common, but not something that should be taken lightly. In fact, thousands of people die each year because of conditions traced back to influenza. The CDC says that as many as 56,000 Americans died during the particularly devastating 2013 to 2014 flu season. Dr. Brian Curtis is on the line now from Peoria to tell us more about the flu and getting vaccinated. He's the physician practice director at OSF Medical Group. Dr. Curtis, welcome to the 21st show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What are you guys seeing already in Peoria and at OSF? What's the flu season going to be like based on what you've already seen in terms of folks coming into you guys?
Right now it's a little early to say what the flu season is going to be like. So it's early October. We tend to usually peak around January or February. It tends to be the peak of our season. And so right now the flu activity is relatively low.
And I guess the weather, does the weather make a difference in that?
It does. And so when you have nicer days, it's kind of like your mom, you know, open up the windows and air out the house. It kind of does the same kind of thing. And so when it's cold, everybody kind of tends to stay inside. And when you have a runny nose, you rub it and then you touch something and then somebody else comes behind you and touches that same thing and picks up that virus. And so getting people outside kind of removes that.
So, Dr. Curtis, let's just go over some of the basics and just remind everybody who exactly and who definitely should consider getting a flu shot.
Anybody over the age of 6 months should get a flu shot unless they have some indication that their physician has indicated that they should not get a flu shot, either having a severe reaction in the past to a flu shot or having some other type of illness that would make it that they couldn't receive that flu shot. But anybody over the age of 6 months should receive one.
And what would you consider a severe reaction?
You know, hives, difficulty breathing. For the most part, flu vaccines are well tolerated. Just usually may have some soreness at the site, maybe some just little soreness all over the body. That's just a reaction to the flu shot, but it's relatively short-lived. And for the vast majority of people, they tolerate it very, very well.
I want to get to some questions people often have about flu vaccinations in a minute, but can I ask you first, when exactly is the best time for someone to get a flu shot? Now, I would assume?
Right now.
It's not too late, right?
No, right now is the perfect time. So it takes about 4 weeks for that flu vaccine to kind of get your immune system ready for it. And so it takes about 4 weeks. So right now, if you get it, kind of you're looking a little beginning of November, mid-November, and then the vaccine lasts for about 4 to 5 months usually. And so you would carry yourself well through flu season.
And can you tell us a little bit about what goes into the vaccine? Because every year there's sort of like a committee, right? Or who determines sort of what goes into what different types of influenza are going to be put into the vaccine?
Sure. And as we've grown as a world population, we've become smaller. And so viruses travel much easier throughout the world. And so usually there's the World Health Organization, the CDC, gets together and see what flu vaccines are circulating throughout the world. And so Australia is just coming out of their flu season. And so you could see what was circulating in Australia and then see that may possibly be what's going to circulate in the Northern Hemisphere. And so the quadrivalent vaccine, which has four influenza types in it, has two A's and two B's in it, are looked at, and then they grow these in either eggs or cells, and then they put them in the vaccine as an inactivated virus, which means that if you get the shot, it's a live virus, but you're not going to transmit that virus to somebody else.
So I think when people say you're getting the shot and it's a live virus, that's something that people sometimes freak out about. Can you explain why that's something that people should not be concerned about?
So these are inactivated viruses, which means that they're just there to show it to your immune system. And so your immune system sees it and develops antibodies to it. And so we get a lot of live virus vaccines. And so throughout our whole life, and your body tends to respond very, very well to them. And so they are inactivated, which means that you're not going to spread them from one person to another. And so really there's very little cause for concerns.
If you have questions or comments about this, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet us at 21STShow. We're speaking with Dr. Brian Curtis in Peoria, where he's the director of physician practice at OSF Medical Group. When you think about I wonder if the recommendations have changed this year for flu season? Dr. Curtis, for example, I know last year recommendations for people with egg allergies were updated. I know that's the other thing you said. Sometimes it grows in eggs. If you have an egg allergy, and I'm not sure what percentage of the population that is, but what kind of precautions do people with those kind of allergies need to take?
Sure. So people with egg allergy can get the vaccine. So that was the updated recommendation. And so they used to say that if you had an egg allergy that you needed to get the shot and then be monitored for 30 minutes within a clinic. And so that was with anybody that had any type of egg allergy. So then they've recently updated saying the people that had severe egg allergies, which means that, you know, they had trouble breathing and they had developed hives, and they actually usually get a medical intervention to stop the allergy response. Those people should be supervised in a healthcare setting prior to receiving the flu shot.
Now, of course, just because you're vaccinated doesn't mean you can't get the flu, correct?
Correct. But as you were saying earlier within your segment, you know, 40-50% of the adult population gets a flu vaccine that's 60% effective. And so if you start looking at immunity strains within a community, the more people that you immunize decreases the likelihood of you actually transmitting a disease within a population. So if you have a 60% effective vaccine and you vaccinate 100% of the population, you know, that's 4 out of 10 people can still get the virus, but there's insulated around them by 6 people that can't get the virus. And so you really start decreasing the circulation of infections throughout the community by increasing your immunization rates.
So I feel like there are different communities of folks out there, and we've had questions from people like this in the past who wouldn't consider themselves anti-vaccination, but they have concerns about getting shots, and they say they've had people who have shared stories about when they had the flu shot, they had reactions, and then they say, well, I'm not going to get vaccinated because other people around me will get vaccinated. What's your response to people who say things like that, to healthy adults who feel like they have concerns and they feel like, well, if everyone else is going to get vaccinated, I don't have to?
Yeah, well, you know, usually we just have a discussion. And, you know, it really depends on where they're coming from and their discussion. And it's, you know, a lot of times we hear, well, I've never had the flu, so why should I get the flu shot? Or my friend got the flu shot and they still got the flu. Or I got the flu from the flu shot. And so really we just have a discussion, and kind of like we talked about before, is that the more people that we immunize prevents that circulation through it. And as you stated, people die every year, adults and children, from influenza. It is not a benign disease. And if you've ever had the flu, you would never want to have the flu again. And And so really we just start looking at where they're coming from within their discussion points, you know, and then you can relate it and say, well, I wear a seatbelt and I've never been in a car accident, but I still put on a seatbelt every day, you know, or I wear a bike helmet. I've never fallen off my bike and had a skull fracture, but I still wear a helmet. And so we're looking at preventative measures within this. And so you'd have everybody do it to decrease the incidence of harm later on.
Apart from a flu shot, what other preventative measures do you think that we should be taking? Washing hands more often, people talk about that. A hand sanitizer, I don't know where you stand on the hand sanitizer front. What do you think about ways that people can be, what things can people do to avoid getting and transmitting the flu?
You know, good hand hygiene is always good. Coughing and sneezing into your elbow, and if you do cough and sneeze into your hands, make sure you wash them. The big thing is if you're sick, stay home. And so don't bring it out to everybody else. You'll recover faster by staying home and resting and drinking plenty of fluids. And people that just kind of go out and tough it out really are just bringing that illness out to everybody else to share. In regards to hand sanitizers, I know there's a lot of debate on them. However, I'm kind of for them because not everybody has soap and water. And so that does give you the opportunity to clean your hands so you don't transmit stuff to other people.
Well, I have to say, as someone who's been spending a lot of time in doctor's offices lately, I always look in the signs that they have in the bathroom in the hospital, and they have the whole how to wash your hands properly picture, which I think people don't think about. That, first of all, to effectively wash your hands, it has to be, what, at least like 20 or 30 seconds, and you need to wash the back of your hands and your wrists. I think a lot of people think hand washing is just running their hands under water.
and wiping them on their pants. You know, usually it's a good 20 to 30 second scrub of, you know, your nails in between your fingers, your thumbs, the backs, the fronts, onto your wrist, and then a good rinse. And it is not just squirting the soap and then rinsing the soap off. I think we should probably model three-year-olds more when we wash hands because they just sit at the sink forever and just rub the soap in their hands and have a great time.
Right.
You know, that's who we should model ourselves after, and that's good hand washing.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And I know there's a great, I think it's a Sesame Street hand washing video where they teach kids how to wash their hands. And I always think that's a good model for doing that. Getting back to the going to work sick, basically your guidelines, if you have a fever, should you not be at work? What else?
You know, if you have a fever, you know, that's going to be kind of the big one. You know, if you have aches and pains and a runny nose and a low-grade fever, you're sick. Yeah, and so you probably, you know, as a physician, you know, I guess, you know, I contradict myself sometimes. But we really should try to stay home and take care of ourselves in order to help us take care of others.
At what point, so let's say you do have the flu, regardless of whether you got the shot or not, fever, chills, muscle aches, what point do you say to somebody who's writing out the flu that they should think about considering getting additional medical attention?
Sure. Difficulty breathing. If you're having any trouble breathing, you probably should be seen by a healthcare professional. Not able to keep liquids down. If you're having decreased urination, showing that you may be getting dehydrated, if you're not acting right, or if the person, your loved one, isn't really kind of acting like their normal selves or kind of confused, that's at a time where they should probably be seen. You know, illnesses that go longer than 7 days of still having fevers after 7 days probably should be evaluated also.
Did you get your flu shot?
I'm going to go get it. I was off last week when they were going around and getting it, but I'm going to get it, and my kids are going to get it, and my wife's going to get it. We're all getting it. Every year we get it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. It's Dr. Brian Curtis from OSF Medical Group in Peoria reminding us that this is the beginning of flu season, and it's a good time to go out and get that flu shot. Thanks so much for taking the time, Dr. Curtis. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Take care.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. If you have it, search for the 21st. It's that little highlight tool. You can find out all of our past shows there. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa or an Amazon Echo device, we're easy to find. You can just tell her, ask NPR One to play the 21st. You do have to have NPR One enabled. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, if you want to send us an email, if you want to follow us on social media and you can't remember our handles, you can go to our website. That's 21stshow.org. Speaking of social media, we're on Twitter and we're very active. I hope we tweeted out that Sesame Street video. Our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. If you search for us on Facebook, you can like the 21st. You can also comment on what we're working on. You can also post questions or comments that you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Alan Montesilio, Bob Holly, and Robin Lynn. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and they have public access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism at Northwestern University in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.